at that, making a quick survey of the activity at the reception desk. Aliza wasn't alone. A group of young women stood close to her, but they weren't interacting with Aliza. The palest and youngest of the three was trying to get a nurse's attention. Aliza squeezed the girl's arm.
"I'll find out," she said crisply.
She caught up to Rachel's group. "Inspector Lemaire, what's the update on Youssef Soufiane? Chloe really needs to know." She gestured at the girl who was waiting at the desk. Lemaire's dismissal wasn't unkind. It was resigned, as though he'd dealt with Aliza's persistence many times in the past. It made Rachel curious. How well did Aliza know the detective from the Sûreté?
"I'm sorry, that information is restricted to family."
Khattak pulled Lemaire aside to ask a question, while Aliza returned to speak to the young woman she'd called Chloe. When Khattak was free, Aliza joined them at the elevator.
"We need to talk," she told them. "I need to show you something important, something that's connected to what happened here tonight. I don't think it can wait."
"How long have you been in Saint Isidore?" Khattak asked.
"A few years now."
She explained that though she was registered at the university, she lived off campus in an apartment she shared, working year-round in town. She knew the campus and community well.
"Let me show you the campus, then I'll tell you the rest."
At her urging, they left their car in the parking lot, skirting the group of reporters. A handful of streetlights illuminated the dark road, trailing away from the hospital up a hill. Aliza was leading them to the university perched at the top, its columns floating like sentinels against a midnight sky. Campus lights illuminated the grounds, thickly forested with maples, whose green leaves darkened to inky blackness as the night encroached. They crossed a bridge over a narrow creek that wound its way along the outskirts of the town. For a moment, that sickening sense of nostalgia flared up in Rachel's thoughts. She was back at a pier looking out over White Pine Lake. A white gazebo stood on the opposite shore, and the space between Rachel and the shore was engulfed by sorrow and loss. Mirage. They hadn't been able to save Mirage, and she'd never expected to meet Aliza Siddiqui again. She chanced a glance at Khattak and saw the same somber expression on his face. They should have returned to the mosque, or failing that, insisted on being present at Lemaire's interview of Etienne Roy, but Aliza's urgency about what she knew was compelling. Rachel was quiet. The bridge gave her an excellent vantage point to view the layout of the town. She measured the distance from the university to the hospital, from the university to the mosque, from the mosque to the dignified church. The importance of the Catholic Church had diminished over the decades. Many in Quebec now viewed it with open distrust. But that was not what Rachel had witnessed in the Sûreté officer's handling of Père Étienne. No, there had been a respect there that bordered on reverence. Looking southward from the bridge, beyond the perimeter of the mosque, the streets of Saint Isidore were empty, save for patrol cars sweeping the dark with their lights. Isabelle Clément, the press liaison, must have made her statement by now to keep the curious away. There might be a shooter at large. Nowhere was truly safe, yet, which was why Rachel kept scanning the streets, watchful for signs of movement. Lemaire hadn't seen fit to hold his own press conference yet, and she admitted that that was probably the right call. It was too soon to say anything that wouldn't raise more questions, so he was right to have his mind on the investigation. Catching the shooter was their top priority. Rachel listened to Khattak's questions as they resumed walking, probing into why Aliza had chosen to come to Saint Isidore and set down roots. There had always been a certain sympathy between Aliza and Khattak.
"Waverly became too small. After everything that happened to Mirage, the people who were involved, I couldn't look at them in the same way, and I wanted to talk about that.
Rachel was confused. You wanted to talk about your sister's murder?
I wanted to talk about what happened in Waverly, where fingers were pointed, why they were pointed. I've never been able to forget. Since then, it's all become so much worse.
When she dipped her head low, shielding her face, Rachel was reminded of the girl she'd met in Waverly, angry that no one apart from herself was willing to tell the truth. From the beginning, the local police had dubbed Miraj Siddiqui's murder an honor killing, and that perception had colored everything about Miraj's life as well as her unnatural death.
Is that the reason you chose to study away from home? Khatak asked.
Again, he perceived nuances that Rachel couldn't detect. When Eliza stopped to look at him, a sense of connection thrummed between them.
It's Quebec, she said simply,
and Saint-Isidore was quick to adopt a code of conduct, an important place for someone who's interested in politics and journalism, because more than anything, this town is an emblem of what that code might become, what it did become. She finished, bitterly. But you'll see that for yourselves in a moment.
Khatak glanced down at Eliza's left hand. You didn't get engaged. It was a question that arose from their history in Waverly.
Eliza pushed her thick, dark hair over one shoulder.
He wasn't ready, so I decided not to wait around.
She shrugged, her glance encompassing Rachel.
If someone doesn't know your worth, why stand still waiting for things to change?
Rachel stumbled as the bridge met the cycling path. Khatak's hand was swiftly at her elbow. They avoided looking at each other. Eliza's matter-of-fact statement applied to them equally. Khatak had wasted years pushing away a woman he'd finally admitted he loved. And Rachel knew no matter how long she was willing to wait for a man she admired, the outcome wasn't going to be the one she'd foolishly hoped for. This had always been Eliza's most disconcerting trait, speaking plainly without apology, willing to face the worst. And now, as then, Rachel wondered how a girl so much younger than she possessed such resolute courage when it came to facing her pain. The answer lay in the reason she gave them for studying in Saint-Isidore. She had been accepted into a graduate program in journalism after having taken time off to acquire relevant work experience. Now, she was following the trail blazed by her sister Miraj. They'd reached the top of the hill and looked back at the town spread below, shrouded in darkness except for the lights of police cars that marked off the scene at the mosque.
You're saying they're connected? Rachel asked.
Eliza led them around the side of the main admissions building, which struck Rachel as quite similar to the church, with its gray stone pediments and ogival windows. These were paired up at the front and arranged as trios along the eastern facade. The building's fenestration was modest, but its central portal could have graced Trinity College. A police car flagged them down, pulling up on the drive under the building's portico. Rachel held up her ID and asked if there was any news. The driver shook his head and circled back to the exit. To the west side of the main college was a student center, fashioned in a more modern style with sleekly positioned Greek columns. The windows were cross-hatched with sparkling panes, their bright and angular symmetry marred by a set of broken panes at the end of the row. Eliza unlocked a door at the back and flipped on the lights. They were standing in the middle of a corridor lined with mahogany doors. Each of the doors was papered with flyers. A nameplate beside each door denoted the presence of various student clubs. The door Eliza had unlocked was marked off with two rows of orange duct tape, establishing an amateur cordon. Rachel instantly knew why. The nameplate on the door indicated that the space had been allocated to the university's Muslim Students Association, or MSA. The door itself had been defaced by a giant swastika. On either side of the frame, a series of graphics had been taped to the wall, each depicting an explicitly racist, fully bilingual cartoon. The orange tape formed a boundary around these graphics, and the door itself was taped across.
This break-in happened 2 days ago.
She explained her role as an active member of the MSA, closely connected to other Muslim students and to the Muslim community in town. She knew the congregation at the mosque, and she would personally know many of the families who were impacted by the tragedy.
They trashed our office, stole our electronics, and did this to the door. I taped it off because although we asked campus security to notify local police, no one has been here yet. I wore gloves.
She said this a little shyly to Hattak.
I didn't touch anything. I've photographed this with my friend Amadou's camera and with my phone, two sets stored in different places. I've also kept a record of my correspondence with the administration and of the calls I made to Inspector Lemaire.
Wait, you've met Lemaire before? Doesn't he work homicide in Montreal? Aliza fished a small square wallet from the back pocket of the jeans she wore tucked into slim black boots. She removed a card from the wallet and passed it to Rachel. It was Lemaire's business card. Rachel handed it to Hattak.
He's been trying to do the same kind of work you do. Every time there's an incident, he rotates through and speaks to the community, assuring them that no problem is too small for us to bring to his attention. He said he's made note of what's been happening in Saint-Isidore.
Hattak was studying one of the graphics on the door. It pictured a bearded man in a turban being chased down a street by a long row of marchers wearing hoods that resembled bishops' mitres. But something about the way the hoods were drawn could also have represented the Ku Klux Klan, except that the faces were unmasked. The same hoods appeared on the graphic next to it, this time worn by a group of men kicking a woman in a burqa who was curled up in a ball on the ground. The manner of drawing suggested that both the woman and the turbaned man were the threat. The viewer's sympathy was meant to be engaged by the faces under the hoods. "Saving you," both graphics read in French and English.
"These men are here," Hattak said flatly. "Whoever they are, they're real. That's why Saint-Isidore is firmly on Lemaire's radar. That's why he keeps coming back."
Aliza pointed to another one of the graphics, higher up on the door. A single handsome figure dressed in one of the hoods had raised his hands in prayer just above a motto at the bottom of the cartoon. The same motto was inked across a sash the young man wore on his chest. Aliza nodded grimly.
"We've been dealing with this for a while, and not with much success."
Rachel strained to read the tiny printing on the sash. An electric jolt shot up her spine. The men in the hoods were called the Wolf Allegiance. Chapter 10. Hattak and Rachel photographed the flyers. Hattak put a call through to Lemaire, asking for the immediate dispatch of a crime scene unit. There was more than a strong possibility that the vandalism of the student group's office and the shooting at the mosque were connected. There were certain features in common. The slashing of the door and the spray-painted swastika indicated the same kind of rage that had characterized the furious rain of bullets inside the mosque. But the posters, designed in advance and neatly arranged around the door in order to tell a story, spoke of premeditation. The same kind of premeditation that had allowed a killer to escape the scene of a mass shooting without being caught. A premeditation that would explain the presence of two different types of weapons, as well as the calculation behind the executions in the basement of the mosque. Four bodies in the basement, one in the hallway upstairs. Cold, precise, purposefully targeted. When the crime scene unit arrived, Aliza took Khatak and Rachel to a coffee shop near campus that was open late. It was crowded with anxious students busily discussing the shooting. A few of them tried to approach, but Aliza waved them off with a frown. From their quick retreat to cell phones, he knew it wouldn't be long before reporters arrived. Rachel went to fetch their drinks, and Khatak took the opportunity to say a few words to Aliza. She looked older than her years, in her mid-twenties now, a gravity in her face that was new, a hardening of purpose that showed in her eyes, but not her face. She was as beautiful as Miraj had been, perhaps more so now with the maturity lent by the passage of time, the kind of beauty reflected in the silent appreciation of young men in the cafe, men who would welcome the chance to rescue her from anything that caused her grief. "You're staring," she said at last, to break the silence, a flush rising to her cheeks. "Was I? I'm sorry. I was thinking of the last time I saw you. I wrote to you after that." "Until you stopped." The families of crime victims often maintained ties with him, meeting before and after the trial phase of proceedings, sometimes needing to share their grief with someone who knew too well everything they had lost. Aliza had also written to Rachel, but it was Khatak whose career she had followed, and Khatak whose advice she sought. He'd treated her the same way he treated his sisters, though perhaps with greater insight into what she needed from him, a space away from her grief, from her family's grief, though Miraj would always be the thread that bound the two of them together. "After the case at Algonquin, you stopped writing." Aliza traced a pattern on the table. "I didn't want to be another of your burdens, or one of your lost causes." Tears sprang to her eyes. Khatak lowered his voice. "How could you have thought that?" She bit her lip. "Because you didn't write me either. You didn't call my parents like you used to. You just vanished." Khatak felt a stirring of regret. He could explain that he'd traveled to Iran, then to Europe and Turkey. He could share the toll those cases had taken, and Aliza would understand. But it wouldn't be the truth. The truth was too sensitive to express. He'd become disturbed by Aliza's dependence on him, worried that she wanted something he couldn't give. After her sister's death, he'd become the significant male figure in her life, too significant. She'd been trying to cross a boundary Issa would never cross. He'd seen distance as the appropriate response. She'd drawn her own conclusions from that. Rather than hurt her, he said, "You're right. After the case in Algonquin, I spent some time working on a de-radicalization project. I'm sorry if that made you think I'd forgotten Miraj or any of you in Waverly." Tears slipped down her cheeks. A young man jerked to his feet from a neighboring table, his anger barely contained. He wore a navy blue blazer over a blue and white shirt. His hair was cut short and well-groomed, his eyebrows a pale shade of blonde. But in spite of his good looks and preppy appearance, he projected an air of menace. "You shouldn't be talking to Aliza without a lawyer. Everything about you screams that you're a cop, both of you." He jerked his chin at Rachel, who had made her way back from the bar, a tray of coffees in hand. Aliza passed a weary hand over her forehead. "Like you care, Maxime. Like you're a friend to anyone like me." Her hands clutched the edge of the table until her knuckles shone white. "Why don't you go back to your wolves?"
What the hell is that supposed to mean?
He took another step closer, and Khatak pushed back his chair. Aliza rose to her feet and faced the young man down.
Ask him where he was tonight, she said to Issa.
Why? Khatak asked, his neutral tone deflating the tension in the room.
Who are you?
He spoke to the younger man directly. He was met with a look of scorn.
I'm not talking to you.
Both hands on her hips, Aliza glared at him, her air of vulnerability erased as if it had never been.
Meet Maxime Thibault. He founded the local chapter of the Wolf Allegiance.
Chapter 11. Catching up quickly, Rachel introduced herself. A nod from Khatak indicated that she should take Maxime aside. She moved to another booth, grabbing her coffee from the tray she passed to Khatak, aware that he was seeking to de-escalate the confrontation between Aliza and the boy. After a moment's indecision, Maxime accepted her invitation to join him, either not wanting to lose face after what he'd said about the police, or because he saw Rachel as a challenge. To disarm him, she called the waitress over and ordered him a drink. As she slid into a seat opposite Maxime Thibault, she made her own lightning-swift assessment of the boy. Despite his posturing, she thought of him as a boy, maybe a couple of years older than her brother, Zach, who was 23. Suave, smooth, and arrogant, Thibault had a chip on his shoulder roughly the size of Quebec. Whether it was aimed at male authority, law enforcement, or something else would take her some time to figure out. His English was fluent, far better than Rachel's French, but his accent wasn't Quebecois. It sounded distinctly Parisian, and everything about him spoke of unlimited wealth. The watch on his wrist, the loafers on his feet, the blazer with its discreetly monogrammed logo. He'd even tucked a pale pink ascot into the neck of his shirt. But why was a kid with money stuck in Saint-Isidore? Granted, it was a much prettier locale than where Rachel had grown up in Etobicoke, but if this kid had been educated in expensive foreign schools, what would bring him to this town?
You're a student at the university?
She sipped at her coffee and waited for him to speak.
How did you end up working for one of them? Sergeant Rachel Getty. That's an upstanding name.
His eyes narrowed.
You're not a fucking kike, are you?
He shook his head.
No, if you were, you'd be in charge, not kowtowing to a raghead.
The vicious insults were shocking in the context of his appearance. When had prep school blazers and knife-edge creases taken the place of white hoods? And if these were Maxime's views, why had he tried to defend Aliza from Khatak? Despite her lighter skin tone, there was no way Aliza could be mistaken for a white woman. On the other hand, her unequivocal beauty could make many an individual set his scruples aside. Rachel slouched down in her seat, projecting an air of fellowship.
Don't think he's wearing a rag, is he?
Thibault's eyes became glassy. He tapped his nose.
On the inside, they're all wearing it on the inside, but they take it off to blend, like Jews who hope they can fool us by anglicizing their names.
He spoke with an air of such reasonableness that Rachel found herself answering him.
Don't know how you feel about the Irish. My dad just liked the name Rachel.
She took another sip of her coffee, and then she said,
Where were you tonight? It's obvious you've heard about the shooting.
Apart from the strange glassiness of his eyes, he was too relaxed for Rachel to imagine that he'd taken part in a mass shooting hours before. He was a young man playing at greater menace.
On campus, he said, hanging out with my friends. Why? Am I a suspect?
He sounded pleased. Rachel shrugged, deliberately offhand.
You can see why I might think that.
That's just lazy police work. Just because a cleansing needed to happen doesn't mean I'm the one who carried it out.
The waitress brought his coffee to their table, and he reached out and squeezed her hand in thanks. She smiled at him as if she knew him, accepting a tip and blowing him a kiss. The contrast between his behavior and his words was chilling.
Maybe not, Rachel agreed. But that wolf allegiance stuff seems like vandalizing the Muslim student's office might have been up your alley. You're a member, right?
His white, even teeth snapped shut. Founder, far above the wolves. Vandalism is for thugs, not for those gifted with vision.
Is that what you are? A visionary?
Of course.
So what's your vision then? Something apocalyptic? Four white horsemen and so on?
Maxime's smile was slow and charming. Rachel wondered if he thought it would disarm her. She'd already assessed the fit of his clothes for a handgun. He had a laptop bag on the seat beside him. She'd have paid good money to search it.
You're mixing your metaphors, Rachel. My brothers represent deliverance, not death. That's what makes it so simple. There's a natural order of things, and I think we can agree on who should be at the top.
Rachel sighed.
What about the ones underneath, then? Are you saying what happened at the mosque was justified?
Thibault inched closer, appraising her. She caught the scent of mint and coffee.
Have you heard of natural selection?
Even his beautiful Parisian accent couldn't make his meaning less ugly. Rachel let him creep closer. From the corner of her eye, she caught Hattak's instant alertness. She made a quick, "I'm okay," motion.
I'd say needing a gun to achieve it is pretty unnatural, wouldn't you? Would you happen to own one? Is there one in your bag?
She nodded at the laptop bag on the seat. Thibault shifted back in his seat, but not before Rachel had seen his blink of confusion.
That's why women shouldn't be in law enforcement. Leave the thinking to men.
He patted his bag.
As if a gun that could do that kind of damage could even fit in this bag.
Rachel sat up straight, focused and intent.
What kind of damage are we talking about, and how do you know about it?
Maxime choked on his coffee, spluttering a little. He used a napkin to wipe his mouth, but all of it was theater. He was buying himself some time.
I've seen a lot of movies, he said. I'm assuming it was an assault rifle, the kind of gun you can get just about anywhere in the States.
Rachel belabored the point.
So you're saying there's no assault rifle in your bag?
His hand tightened on the bag.
That's what I'm saying.
Mind if I look for myself?
He hesitated, and Rachel pressed her advantage.
Natural selection suggests a mind like yours would dispose of the weapon as soon as possible.
No details about the shooting had been revealed on the news. The Canadian press were notoriously taciturn. They would wait for the facts to be established. Canadian police officers were even more so. So Maxime wouldn't know the rifle had been found on the scene and that what Rachel was really looking for was the missing handgun. Falling into the trap, Thibault shoved the bag at her.
Go ahead, you stupid dyke.
Rachel snagged the bag from his hands and checked each of its zippered compartments, taking her time. She found a laptop, a spare ascot, a student handbook, and some papers. When she moved to unzip an inner pocket, Thibault's hands jerked as if to stop her. She looked up at him, and he shrugged. A hush had fallen over the cafe. Everyone was watching Rachel search the bag. A couple of Maxime's friends came to stand behind him, their arms crossed over their chests. They were dressed in the same preppy uniform, the lieutenants of Maxime's movement.
Nazis, she muttered as she dug her hand deep inside the pocket.
Something solid bumped against her knuckles. She fished it out. It was a mobile phone.
That's mine, he said sharply. Put it back.
Puzzled, she slid it back, her hand brushing against a piece of paper. Seeing Maxime tense, she slipped the sheet of paper from the bag and laid it on the table. Though he met her gaze defiantly, he didn't say a word. It was a copy of one of the flyers she had seen at Aliza's office. Chapter 12. Lemaire sent members of his team to pick up Thibault, extending an invitation for Rachel to join the interview. Khatak told her to go. He'd walk back and join her at the trailer where Lemaire had set up camp. It was nearly midnight, and the temperature had dropped. When Aliza told him she intended to return to help the families at the mosque, he walked her back. He didn't want her out alone on the streets after midnight. He offered her his jacket, but she refused.
Maybe it was for the best that you didn't write,
she admitted.
I needed to figure things out on my own. I needed to start again, and now I have.
The dark shadow of a desecrated mosque lay between them, and for a moment they observed it in silence.
Something about you is different, she said. You seem lighter somehow.
He was surprised by her observation. After what's happened here? In her usual forthright way, she said,
You haven't faced what's happened here yet. It's too soon for it to be real. You seem happier. Have you met someone?
Aliza smiled a little sadly at the quick response she read in his face.
Does she love you?
She must, Khatak thought. She did. Seher hadn't stayed in Greece to hurt him, or to make him pay for his long years of silence. She might not accept that the time they had spent struggling to find their way was warranted, valuable, even, but she wasn't the kind of woman who thought her mystique increased the more she held herself back. Like Aliza, she was forthright about what she wanted. He smiled sideways at her.
Not nearly as much as I love her.
He changed the subject. They were close to the mosque, and he still had questions to ask. Do you think Maxime Thibault is the one behind the attack? She took some time to consider, kicking a small stone over the bridge into the creek. A river of mist shrouded the bridge, making it seem cut off from the town spread out below. He wouldn't think about what waited at the mosque. He would focus on the assailant, the mass murderer. Aliza's breath whooshed from her chest.
I wonder if he's clever enough. I'm not sure that he is, but I have this feeling.
He could no longer see her in the fog. Her voice was as cool and shadowy as the moonlight silvering the fog.
Whoever did this found it easy to disappear. Maybe that's because they're one of us.
Someone from the mosque, he said sharply.
No.
Her voice floated back at him.
I meant someone from Saint-Isidore. Someone we know, go to school with, work with. Someone who can keep their composure after they've committed an atrocity. I don't know if that fits what I know of Maxime, but there's a chance that it does.
Her face appeared again. She was hugging her bare arms, and Khatak insisted she take his jacket. She buttoned it close around her, easing into its warmth. After a moment, Khatak commented,
He was certainly behind the vandalism of your office, yet at the same time he was protective of you. Do you find that odd?
She answered with some reluctance.
He wasn't like this when I first met him. We started off as friends.
She looked embarrassed.
It took me a while to see that he wanted more than friendship, but before I could figure out a way to let him down, he fell in with this other crowd, and then he became someone else. He became the kind of person who could join the Wolf Allegiance.
She shivered.
It flies in the face of everything he now stands for, but he hasn't stopped pursuing me.
Khattak's stomach churned. Has he threatened you? Or harassed you? Or anything worse? He wanted to ask, but couldn't bring himself to.
She flashed him a compassionate glance, and he was struck, as always, by Aliza's self-possession. Her friends were likely among the dead at the mosque, yet she tried to reassure him. They were silent until they reached the mosque. There were families gathered in the parking lot, alongside other members of the congregation. Aliza nodded at them, seeing people she knew. Turning from him, she said,
I'll be all right. I'm going to stay here until they leave, then I'll go home with one of the families. They're going to need support. I won't walk back to campus on my own.
They both remembered that Miraj had been alone by the lake on the night of her murder.
You didn't answer me about Thibaut. He tried to suppress the protectiveness in his voice, the concern that exasperated Ruksh, the older of his two younger sisters. Aliza heard it anyway and reached out to press his hand.
He's never touched me, she said. He won't. He prides himself on some twisted notion of chivalry. I've asked myself if the way he harasses us on campus or down at the mosque is simply his way of getting my attention.
Then he's not a racist? He's just looking for a way to impress you?
Oh, he's a racist, she said matter-of-factly.
A Nazi through and through. And I don't mean that as a casual slur. It's the Wolf Allegiance's stated ideology.
But he hasn't been able to let go of me.
And surprisingly, that's not completely at odds with the Wolves' ideology. They like the idea of submissive Asian girlfriends who take their orders from them. For a moment, her mask of preternatural calm shifted, and he witnessed the raw and very real pain beneath it.
But I've known men like you, Issa. So why would I look at him?
He was too humbled by the words to respond. He took out his phone to check for an update from Lemaire, hoping to change the subject. He frowned as he saw a text from an unfamiliar number.
I've been waiting for you. Now that you're here, let's begin.
The text had the unsettling language of a threat. Seeing his frown, Aliza peered over his shoulder to read the text.
Does this seem like something Thibaut might say? He asked her. Or that he would have one of the members of his group send?
The number flashed up as unknown. She looked dubious.
We call them the Wolves or the Allegiance. How would they have your number? They're not hackers. They're just bored and easily distracted.
But the graphics on the MSA's door had been sophisticated, well-timed, and well-placed. Was it possible that the graphics had gone up first, and someone driven by cruder instincts had been inspired to spray-paint the swastika? Did the act of vandalism somehow mirror the dual nature of the attack at the mosque?
Aliza was watching his face.
Amadou would know, she said. What's going to happen to him, Issa? Can you protect him? Can you get me in to see him?
He said the two of you were friends and that you'd told him about me. Did he have some reason for thinking I'd come to Saint-Isidore?
Aliza tilted her head to one side. Though his jacket was oversized on her, she looked anything but defenseless. She was measuring him, weighing what she wanted to say.
I'm reminded of a five-act play. She pointed down at the mosque that had now become a crime scene. This is the fifth. The vandalism of our offices counts as the fourth. But there were other things that happened before this. I wanted to call you after the first, but both Amadou and Youssef said that we should wait. He thought we could handle things ourselves. Suddenly her calm deserted her, and Eliza began to cry. With great, gulping sobs, she said,
"We waited too long. I waited too long. This is my fault, Issa. Everything that's happened, each of the acts, is because of something I did."
"No, it isn't." He offered the words softly, not drawing close, not reaching for her to console her. She needed to stand alone, just as she needed to cry. It wouldn't be the last time. He didn't know what she was referring to, but he didn't need her to elaborate. He knew exactly what Eliza was trying to tell him. The massacre at the mosque was a climax. The case was about beginnings. Chapter 13. Take No Prisoners Campus Radio Call-In Show. Translated from the French. Today's host, Eliza Siddiqui. Welcome to the program, Alain. I understand that you have some concerns about how the Saint-Isidore mosque shooting is being portrayed in the national media. You think the coverage is making Quebecers look bad.
I do. All we want is to hold on to our culture and heritage.
French language and culture, just to clarify?
Yes. What's wrong with that?
Nothing at all, but why can't others hold on to theirs, Alain?
Because they're not like us. They're against us.
From the shooting at the mosque, it would seem like it's the other way around.
I'm not talking about the shooting. I'm talking about Quebec.
Fair enough. But don't you think that at some point that's where all this "they're not like us, they're against us" rhetoric leads? One day you're writing a Quebec First Facebook post. Then to kick it up a notch, you and your friends form a quiet little anti-Muslim group. 2 months later, you've got 40,000 members, and the next thing you know, you're organizing, getting guns, and somebody goes off script.
Unless that is your script.
You're putting words in my mouth. I didn't say anything like that.
I'm just asking you to think about where this leads. Why even start this up?
I'm talking about Francophone rights. I won't apologize for being Quebecois.
I'm not asking you to. I'm saying maybe don't assume being Quebecois gives someone the right to shoot up a mosque.
You're forgetting we were here first.
So that means French culture is what matters? You should be able to hold on to it, preserve it, pass laws that make sure it's protected, and get the whole country to agree?
Yes, now you're getting what I'm saying.
By that logic, what about Quebec's First Nations? They were here first. They deserve to preserve their culture, languages, treaty rights. They don't want to be erased by an onslaught of people who don't act or look like them.
You cannot compare the accomplishments of the French civilization with savages who hunt the buffalo.
And you don't think your sentiments are racist? When what you're saying is that it's not so much that the French were here first, before the immigrants and other riffraff, it's more that French culture is superior, and that's why it should be protected at the expense of everyone else.
Obviously. Would you rather see a woman in a bikini on a beach or in a shroud you could wrap around a corpse?
So then what you're really talking about is French supremacy, white supremacy, if I'm hearing you correctly. Does that make you a white supremacist?
I didn't agree to come on your show so you could insult me.
This is a call-in show. I didn't solicit your call in particular, but are you saying it's an insult to be called a white supremacist?
You're calling me a Nazi.
That was your word, not mine. Are you definitively telling me that you're not a Nazi and you don't support white supremacist beliefs?
Fuck off and die, Becky bitch.
Call terminated. And that concludes the latest episode of Take No Prisoners, where we discussed white nationalism in Quebec. Thanks for tuning in.
Chapter 14. Maxime Thibault was brought in to be interviewed. The flyer Rachel had found in his note case linked him to the destruction of the MSA office. They couldn't ignore that link. That unfettered act of vandalism could now be seen as a precursor to the shooting at the mosque. The flyer Rachel had found in Thibault's bag was suggestive of the first possibility, but the interview with Maxime Thibault didn't take place in the incident room. Instead, Thibault was taken to the local police station, the interview conducted personally by Le Maire, while Khatak and Rachel watched from the other side of a semi-transparent window. Within moments, it became clear that, like Étienne Roy, Thibault was receiving treatment that had not been meted out to Amadou Duchamp. Le Maire had established a relaxed atmosphere. They had the camaraderie of two men who knew each other well. As she listened to the pace of proceedings, Rachel's disquiet deepened.
"What the hell is this?" she muttered to Khatak. "It should be obvious that Maxime Thibault's group of neo-Nazis is responsible for defacing that door, and more than likely that they played a role in the attack. Thibault is probably the ringleader."
Khatak shared what Aliza had told him with Rachel. She supposed it was something to consider, that Maxime was like a little boy who pulled a girl's pigtails for her notice, but it certainly wasn't the whole story. His poise and self-confidence, his utter lack of remorse, whatever role his group played in this place so close to the nation's capital, he was thinking of more than Aliza. Something ugly was festering under the surface of this town. She'd sensed it outside the mosque. She'd felt it at the hospital and in her interactions with local officers, as if they all knew a secret Rachel hadn't figured out. And now, someone was bringing Thibault a piping hot cup of tea. Rachel's eyebrows shot up. Thibault was a suspect in a terrorist attack. What if he flung the tea in Le Maire's face? But Le Maire didn't seem worried. He was slumped back in his chair, his arms folded over his chest, and he sounded as though he had no more on his mind than a chat with an old and dear friend.
"He's trying to gain his confidence," Khatak murmured.
Rachel shook her head.
"No, they know each other, sir. There's already a pattern there. Listen to the way Thibault keeps calling Le Maire patron. I've got a bad feeling about this. This guy should be in handcuffs."
One of Le Maire's team members took exception to Rachel's words.
"Don't tell us how to do our jobs. There are no guns registered to Thibault. He has no criminal record. He's never even been charged with something as minor as public disorder."
Rachel shifted to face the other man, whose name she hadn't caught. Photographs from the mosque's multiple crime scenes were scattered over his desk.
"Public disorder doesn't seem so minor now, or haven't you noticed?"
He scowled at her, but when Khatak flicked him a glance, he subsided into his seat. All Khatak said mildly was, "There are other ways to get a gun." They both turned back to the interview. Le Maire asked Thibault about the vandalism on campus. He shrugged it off.
"They're making something out of nothing. It was just a little harmless fun."
"So you're admitting you papered the office with those flyers?"
Thibault smirked.
"Can't deny it, can I? That cow of a woman saw it in my bag."
Le Maire adjusted the edge of the table with care.
"I'm sorry, who?
The Anglo-Kike? The one who looks like the side of a mountain?"
Rachel's ears burned. Her body was abruptly doused in sweat. She'd heard worse, on the ice, at home, at work, but never in front of Khatak.
or someone like Christian Lemaire. She froze, not looking at the others in the room. Khatak faced her head on.
He's a Nazi, Rachel. The only thing that's ugly here is him.
Thibault was grinning over at the window like he knew, and again Rachel was struck at the rot concealed behind his smooth facade. The days of skinheads were over. The racists had changed their guise. She gave an offhand shrug.
I'm not bothered. I'm pretty sure I could take him.
His head down, Lemaire's officer grinned into his collar. His whisper was thickened by his Quebecois accent, but Rachel heard him anyway.
Kikes like to talk big.
Khatak leaned forward and rapped on the window. Lemaire looked up with a frown. He eased out of his chair, leaving Thibault to cool his heels. When he entered the outer room, his gaze lingered on Rachel's flushed face.
Sir, she said to Khatak, don't.
Khatak ignored her. He pointed to Lemaire's man. Your officer just insulted my partner. I want him off this case. Lemaire's eyes widened with surprise. He jerked his head at his subordinate. They exchanged a rapid volley in French, the younger man with a sulky cast to his face.
He insulted you?
Lemaire verified. Rachel's face was burning, but she looked Lemaire dead in the eye.
I've heard worse. So has Inspector Khatak.
He frowned over at Khatak.
I'm concerned that we're a little short of manpower.
Khatak looked over at Thibault behind the glass, and then back at Lemaire's officer.
I'm concerned about the excess of Nazi effluvium when we're interrogating Nazis.
Nazis?
He challenged Khatak.
That's a little harsh, isn't it?
They've been painting swastikas. That's what I find harsh.
Lemaire barked something at his officer, who quickly escaped the room. He made a polite half-bow at Rachel.
You won't have to deal with him again.
He noticed Khatak's skepticism and said,
What? What fault have you found now?
But Khatak didn't tell him, and at his urging, Lemaire returned to the interview. Rachel sighed, her hands clenched into fists. She didn't need Khatak to fight her battles. It made her look weak when she needed to appear as invulnerable as any man on the team.
You've heard a lot worse about yourself, sir.
It's different for me, Rachel.
Rachel sized Khatak up, his grave demeanor, his steady presence. As usual, it made her furious.
Christ almighty, sir, why the hell are you so calm? You know what's happened here, and I'm pretty sure you know which way the wind is blowing.
As usual, he was patient with Rachel. Dignified in a way she couldn't hope to emulate when she was giving free rein to her anger.
I actually prefer this, Rachel. I prefer it when the enemy comes out into the open. It's the ones who smile at you while they're plotting in the dark that I've learned to worry about. That's why I called him out.
Her voice a little scratchy, she said,
That wasn't your sense of chivalry kicking into overdrive again.
He shook his head, his smile a little wry.
What you think of me, Rachel? Perhaps it was a little of that, but mainly I'm beginning to worry that as gruesome as the shooting is, as wretchedly evil, there's more going on in this town.
Rachel had been thinking the same thing. She nudged Khatak to put it into words. Glancing at Rachel, he rested a hand on the glass partition. Sometimes the monsters we fear aren't on the opposite side.
Chapter 15. You can lead this interview if you like.
They were in the lounge, which had been emptied out so Lemaire could have the room to himself to speak with Père Étienne, now that the interview with Thibault had concluded with his release. They didn't have anything to connect Thibault with the shooting yet, but that didn't mean they wouldn't find something as their inquiries progressed. The station was overheated, the lounge cramped and stuffy, not a place where big men could find themselves at ease. Various flyers had been posted to a bulletin board, notices of services available to the community tacked up between posters of wanted men, members of biker gangs, tattooed according to their creed, featured heavily in this mix. Rachel found a chair that she thought might accommodate her size, leaving the sturdier one across from it for Lemaire. She felt a little uncomfortable at his unexpected benevolence, though it was far less troubling than the fact that this was the place he was planning to interview Étienne Roy. A junior officer ushered Roy into the room. He was urged to the room's only sofa, and a cup of coffee was placed at the table by his elbow. He was then asked in deferential tones if he needed anything else. As he expressed his thanks in a still dazed voice, Lemaire signed off on reports brought to him by another officer.
1 hour, he told his team. We make no public statements before then, and if he doesn't like it, the mayor can kiss my ass.
Rachel's ears perked up at that. Her favorite kind of cops were ones who hated politicians, and if Lemaire fit into that category, she was willing to cut him some slack. She switched her attention to Roy. He was younger than she'd expected, perhaps 50 years of age, with a face that revealed that this was his first real encounter with tragedy. He seemed muddled by the events that had just unfolded. Rachel wondered how such a helpless individual could oversee the needs of a large congregation, let alone summon up the dispatch to carry out a crime like this. Lemaire sat down heavily across from her, angling his chair between Rachel and the priest. He nodded at her, and she began. He might not like her technique, but if he was giving her carte blanche, she knew what she wanted to ask. Why were you holding the assault rifle, Père Étienne? She sensed Lemaire's surprise at the precision of her accent and her use of the correct form of address. She ignored it, keeping her eyes on the priest. She followed up her question by repeating it in French and asking if he'd prefer for her to conduct the interview in his own language. Étienne Roy blinked at her, his eyes large and round behind his owl-shaped glasses, his lashes sandy and sparse. His hands trembled in his lap. He answered her in English.
I don't know. I don't know what compelled me to pick it up. It was there on the floor, and when I saw the bodies everywhere, I thought perhaps I should move the weapon out of the way.
Her voice cool and precise, she said, You're saying you didn't fire the weapon? It wasn't you who opened fire on the people who'd come to pray at the Al-Salam Mosque? Lemaire's sharp eyes shifted to Rachel, but he didn't interrupt.
Roy expelled his breath on a sob.
Fire it? No, of course I didn't. Those were my friends inside the mosque. Even were they not, I am a man of God. I would never take the life of another of God's creatures.
He appealed to Lemaire, who waved the appeal aside.
Désolé, Père Étienne. Please just answer our questions. It will help us to resolve this.
So he'd made up his mind, Rachel thought, with a quiet little flicker of protest. She'd been starting to like Lemaire, but he'd released Thibault with a warning while Amadou was still under guard. Not that Rachel believed anyone at the scene was entitled to the benefit of the doubt. She was trying to fulfill her mandate, the mandate that required her to treat all suspects as equal, with the same presumption of innocence.
Where did you enter the mosque from?
The side entrance?
A small corroboration of Amadou Duchamp's story. If he'd entered from the side door, it was conceivable that Amadou wouldn't have seen him, nor would the priest necessarily have seen Amadou.
Before or after you heard the attack begin?
He looked uncertain, confused perhaps by her phrasing.
I didn't hear the attack. I heard people crying. I thought I heard a young man calling out.
Did you recognize his voice?
Not in all that chaos. But later I saw Amadou outside in the parking lot. He was being arrested.
Did you hear him before you entered the mosque or after?
Père Étienne shook his head. I'm not sure. Things were happening so fast. I'm trying to reconstruct what happened in my mind when I really should be at my church. I need to set up services for the families who are grieving tonight. My congregation will be eager to help.
Will they? Rachel stared at the priest without blinking, wondering what he would make of the starkness of her question. He rubbed his beard, made an abortive little swipe for the cross he wore at his neck, then looked from Rachel to Lemaire and back.
Yes, he said. Of course. Why would you think otherwise?
Rachel considered her options. She could confront him with the things that were on her mind, the inside information she and Khattak had gleaned from Aliza, or with tidbits from the rancorous anti-Islam debate taking place in the province of Quebec. Or she could stay quiet in her seat and wait him out. She chose the latter option, and after a moment of tense silence, Père Étienne hurried into speech. Without being prompted, he took them through the scene from the moment of his arrival to the instant he'd picked up the gun. He'd been running late for a meeting with the imam. He met with the imam regularly to discuss an interfaith initiative they'd undertaken with a local rabbi. Because the imam wasn't in his office, he'd entered the hallway to search for him, realizing he might still be at prayer. He hadn't noticed the body in the hallway right away, heading straight into the main hall. What he'd seen there had caused him to drop to his knees. Rachel looked the priest over. He was wearing the same clothes he'd been wearing at the scene. They hadn't been entered into evidence. In silent witness of Père Étienne's words, the knees of his dark brown slacks were discolored, possibly by blood. His shirt was also stained.
I think that's when I heard the voice, someone calling out for help. I went into the hallway and saw a man's body at the far end. The gun was beside it on the floor. I couldn't believe what I was seeing. It was such a shock. There was so much blood in the prayer hall. There was more at the end of the hallway. I went to the man. I turned him over to see if I could help.
His voice broke over the words, his pupils growing larger, his breathing harsh in his chest.
I couldn't. I was certain he was dead. So I picked up the gun to make sure no one else could use it.
Did you call the police? Did you check on anyone in the hall? Shame crept over his face, and the priest bowed his head.
I should have done something. I should have done more to help. I was stunned. Christian, you must believe me. By the time I gathered myself together, the police had arrived to secure the scene. You were there, mon fils. You saw. You were the one who took the gun away.
Lemaire reached over and patted the priest's knee, a gesture that shocked Rachel. Did no one at this station observe protocol? Not even the man in command? No wonder a member of Lemaire's team had felt confident enough to call her by a racial slur. She cleared her throat with some fanfare.
Père Etienne, you said you left the imam's office and observed nothing to distress you in the hallway. You went straight into the prayer hall without any idea of what you'd see there. Is that correct? He nodded.
Yes, that is exactly how it happened. It is my duty to tell you the truth.
You were in the habit of visiting the mosque, you said. You knew the congregation.
Yes, he said again. Of course. We organized many joint activities for our congregations, along with the Temple Beth Synagogue.
So you'd be familiar with observances inside the mosque. Bewildered by her line of inquiry, the priest nodded again. Rachel looked down at his footwear, scuffed and bloodied from his presence on the scene. She leaned closer to him, her sharp brown eyes unwavering as they examined his face.
Perhaps you'll be able to tell me then if you thought nothing was amiss before you entered the hall. Why did you enter the prayer space while you were still wearing your shoes?
Etienne Roy went still, a boneless stillness that failed to conceal his distress or the slight glimpse of a strange emotion roiling beneath the surface. Lemaire swore to himself in French. Rachel waited both men out. At last, Roy spoke with an air of irritability.
It happened so quickly, I am still in shock. I may have the sequence of events wrong. I might have seen the body in the passageway and therefore rushed into the hall. To tell you the truth, mademoiselle, it's become something of a jumble in my mind. I will need long hours of reflection before I can be certain.
Rachel's smile didn't reach her eyes.
Pas de problème, Père Etienne. Take all the time you need. There's just one other matter I'd like to clear up, if I may.
I don't think she breezed over the interruption.
If you saw the body in the passageway first, did you also then notice the gun?
Chapter 16 Wolf Allegiance Chat Room, translated from the French. Subject: Père Etienne in custody. Closed group. Broadsword Ben.
We need to make a move. We need to get him out.
Maximum damage.
It's cool.
9-inch Nailer.
How is it cool? They've got our fucking priest.
Maximum damage.
We have people inside. Père Etienne has people.
White Victory.
And we should trust you, why?
Maximum damage.
You ready to take on the big dog?
White Victory has left this chat.
Maximum damage. Anyone else?
Broadsword Ben.
Just give us something.
Maximum damage.
They're not doing anything to Père Etienne. They know the mosque is a base for terrorists.
Flay all the players.
Yeah, but what is Père Etienne telling them?
Maximum damage.
He'll say what he has to say. The question is, what is he thinking? What is it he's not saying?
9-inch Nailer.
Sounds like you know the answer.
Maximum damage.
Don't you? If you're one of them, you follow the religion of war, and if you follow the religion of war, the Christian God says you're the enemy. We've been playing by the rules while they've been chopping off heads, so join the crusade. Join us, because our values are truly fucking superior.
Flay all the players.
Impressive. You really think a priest would talk like that?
Maximum damage.
Fuck if I know what you guys want from me.
Flay all the players.
No, that was good.
If that's what Père Etienne told them, all I can say is that's good.
9-inch Nailer.
Yeah, but what about the AR-15? He was found with the gun in his hand.
Broadsword Ben.
Christ, you're obsessed with that gun.
9-inch Nailer.
If we're fighting a global war at some point, we need to arm.
Maximum damage.
Just lay low for now. Keep an eye on that muzzy cup.
Broadsword Ben.
What about the Devil's Duo?
A&A?
Yeah,
Their office was trashed, but they're still on the radio. You want we should make it personal? Maximum damage. I said, lay low. I'll take care of the rest.
Chapter 17. Khatak had sustained an uneasy relationship with Diana Shahada for years. Sometimes their work overlapped, sometimes they were at odds over a direction Diana argued he should have taken pursuing a particular inquiry. Diana didn't hold back when it came to telling Khatak where she thought he'd erred, lately with greater frequency. He was under no illusions about how the current investigation was likely to play out. If Diana couldn't influence him, she would cast him as an adversary and demand a recalibration of his efforts and of community policing. It was nearly 4 a.m. The scene outside the mosque had been cleared, and they stood together at the far end of the parking lot, away from the glare of the lights set up outside Lemaire's center of operations. Khatak was hoping that a little conciliation in advance would buy him some flexibility as the investigation rolled on. They waited while the last few bodies were loaded into mortuary vans, and quietly and privately they offered prayers over the scene. Aliza's insights were as sharp as ever. She was right. He hadn't faced the shooting at the mosque, not what it truly meant. He didn't want to. He wasn't certain what shape this new reality would assume or what it would bleed from him when it had ended. Diana's phone had been buzzing since he'd come to meet her, and now she turned it off and put it away. "Can we just talk about this honestly?" For once, she didn't sound confrontational. Her tone was despairing, at odds with the aura of invincibility she projected during her interviews. She was young and attractive, her chestnut hair tamed into waves that framed her intelligent face. Her professional dress was like a uniform, her suits either black or navy blue, her blouses buttoned up to the throat. She'd been on her feet since she arrived, either coordinating the MCLU's response on her phone, or seeking information from various law enforcement agencies, or lending an ear to those who'd waited outside the mosque through the long hours of uncertainty. "Of course, Diana." He gave her a respectful nod. "I'm happy to speak to you as long as you aren't confusing honesty with full disclosure." A curious frown settled on her brow. "Why shouldn't I? Some matters must remain within my discretion while the investigation proceeds." She gave an exasperated sigh, pinching at her collar again. "Can there be any doubt about what's happened? The priest was found with the gun in his hands. The whole point of being at the scene is to ensure they don't try to make that go away." "There's always doubt," he warned her. "These are still early stages. We have to ask ourselves why a Catholic priest who served on an interfaith committee with Al-Salam's imam would devise an attack against the mosque. Does that make sense on its face?" Diana's head swung around to the mosque, then back to the activity at the trailers. "Just whose side are you on?" she asked, moodily. Issa suppressed a sigh. These were the kinds of comments he loathed, a construction of binaries, where people were either with you or against you, with no common ground in between. He'd hoped that a leader of Diana Shahada's caliber would be well past these questions by now. But any response he made along these lines was bound to sound condescending. He spoke cautiously, hoping she'd hear his undertone of humor. "I'm on no one's side. I am for justice, no matter who it's for or against." Diana had been asked the same question about her loyalties during a now infamous parliamentary debate. Khatak had just quoted back Diana's indignant response. She wanted to be angry at him, but a smile twitched the corners of her wide-lipped mouth. You would remember that.
He smiled too, a little rueful.
Hard to forget the way you made your mark.
She rubbed the back of her neck, releasing the tension there. Then, almost as if grasping his cautiously tendered olive branch, she said,
So what can you tell me, Isa? What are your honest thoughts about what will happen next?
There's a search on. If Etienne Roy isn't responsible for the shooting, then someone else is, or he may have had an accomplice. But there are two things you should know up front. He told her about the vandalism of the student office.